I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast for Stage 9 of the Tour de France, the last stage before the first rest day. We haven't had a Tour de France in a couple of years, which had 9 stages straight in a row. This was from Saint-Léonard-de-Noblat to Puy-de-Dôme, a finish that hasn't been used for a number of years, a road that I don't even think riders can do a recon of, except for the day that ASO organized it. I think it was 2 days before the Dauphiné. And yeah, it's an up and down stage with a lot of elevation gain, with short climbs, very, very hot conditions, well over 30 degrees. And then the Puy de Dôme finish, which is in two parts. The first 5.5 Ks are at 7%, then a flatter section of 2 Ks, and then the final ramp is 4.5 Ks at 11.5% with steep pinches, 2 Ks at 12% average. Really, really difficult finish. It's like it circles around a mountain and there's no crowd on it. They blocked off the last 3 Ks or so out of Clermont-Ferrand. Anyway, the big question, Benji, was who was going to chase? Because it was sort of 1-1 for UAE and Jumbo-Visma. Mm-hmm. Pogacar got dropped on Marie Blanc. Pogacar dropped Vingegaard on Colteray. And so who was going to pace for this sort of mountaintop finish, if anybody? And the answer was no one.
No one paced in the peloton indeed, which meant that the breakaway had free launch for the stage afterwards. But let's discuss the breakaway formation phase for a second here. We had riders going into there, Bernal, Kwiatkowski, Cavagna all trying, but it was actually the first breakaway that actually went from the start. So Paulus, Mohoric, Berthe, which was very good on Marie Blanc for Gull, Izaguirre, Mathieu Jorgensen, Michael Woods with a tug buddy, Boivin, Campenaerts, De La Cruz, Lutsenko, Abrahamsen, Greggaard, Bourgeois, and Latour. So quite a few climbers with like a tug buddy rider. But next to that, also a few rollers in there that you would, before you watch this stage, you would argue that a Mohoric and a Campenaerts don't have a chance on the finishing climb and they need to attack before the final climb if you see that group, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was the clear play. And Woods was living on borrowed time on this stage because he needed that tug buddy of Guillaume Bovin to monitor these people. And yeah, other people had that as well, like Gorka Izaguirre, sort of. I think he was more a climbing option. I was hoping it would be Berthe and Felix Gall in the breakaway. I think I picked Gall for the stage, but he wasn't able to get in the break, and they would have still been happy with Berthe. He was strong on Marie Blanc. But what does this say from the peloton? That no one, well, I guess if you're not UAE or Jumbo, Bora not going to think Hindley can take time on this.
Exactly. So they don't want them to necessarily do that because they also think, okay, on the climb itself, UAE and Jumbo are probably going to take control anyway, and we don't need to control the entire stage to see that happen. When it comes to other teams outside of UAE and Jumbo, you've got the likes of Ineos, who tried to get in the break but failed
with Bernal,
Martinez, Kwiatkowski, I think probably with some other eyes as well. Quick step with Cavagna, but completely failed getting in there as well because they wait until the gap it's kind of already a minute to try and bridge, but that won't work.
It was bizarre. So like the break's gone. It's got 1 minute. There's multiple riders with teammates in that breakaway group of 14 riders, like at least 5 teams with 2 riders. So they're going to pull and they're going to put one guy like Abrahamsen for Greggaard is going to just pull and Bovin for Woods. And then, it's a minute they start moving. And then Jumbo and UAE were like, no. There's no more, break is done, we're shutting down the stage. Yeah. Like Van Aert, I think, blocked a quick step move. Yeah. And quick step a couple of days in a row. They've not done the break formation. They've not managed it well, frankly.
Yeah, I agree. Now, that was basically it when it comes to the break formation. But I do want to mention, we discussed all the teams except UAE and Jumbo. What do you think the reasoning is? Because if I think about those previous stages, you mentioned it before, there's a 1-1 right now before the stage starts. Pogacar did what he did at Tourmalet on Colteret, dropped Vingegaard, took time back. The day before, Vingegaard spread his wings on Marie Blanc and flew away for a minute. So we've got a 1-1 situation, and with a finish that looks a lot like Marie Blanc the last 4 kilometers, it's a different running. Like there's climbing before the last 4 kilometers, but the last 4 kilometers of this climb, Puy de Dôme, are steep. that kind of gives Jumbo some thought, maybe we can do something. But then again, they don't need to fight for the stage because they don't necessarily have the full confidence either that they'll take bonus seconds on Pogacar, while Pogacar at UAE is also thinking, oh, are we 100% sure that if we control the stage, that Pogacar will win the stage and the bonus seconds will be for ours? Does that show anything?
I think you're right. It's just both are not confident. I still was surprised that UAE didn't pace because I can't remember the last mountaintop finish that was like a basic, I mean, it's not a uni puerto, but that's a little bit simplistic. This was a hard stage to control, but I can't remember the last climb they or stage like this they didn't pace and go for the stage win. And I think after today, maybe they'll rue not doing that. But yeah, breakaway forms, it goes and no one chases. Jumbo Visma, they let it go out to like 10 minutes and it keeps going out. It even goes out to 16 minutes because no one in that break is a threat to anybody. They're like 20 minutes plus back on GC. And Laporte's pacing, not much really happens in the stage, I don't think.
Oh,
a couple of bee stings, but some crashes.
Yeah, Jorgensen got a bee sting in his helmet, which probably is not the most fun thing to happen. And Calmejean crashed because they're obviously this entire stage, the starting spot was a memory of Poulidor, because I'm pretty sure he's buried there after he passed away. And Alpecin got these like purple yellow stripes on their shorts and so forth. And there was a fan that had like these, like this thing across their caravan, like a little rope thingy with like little Poulidor shirts. And Calmejean saw them from up close.
Yeah, they took him out, and Steph Kruse said yesterday as well that I think a spectator's flag or something took him out, so that was unfortunate. I was glad. I actually liked the climbs being fenced off. I know that's, you know, not the spirit of ciclismo, but in COVID it was actually much less stressful watching the climbs when, it got fenced off and there's no one infringing upon the riders.
Vincenzo Nibali, was it Alpe d'Huez where he got rode into a photographer, bumped into him, and he broke his back and was out of the Tour de France?
Not sure. It was. Okay.
Memories. Sad memories.
Nibali memories. Anyway, what's clear, Benji's already mentioned it, we'll talk about the breakaway first, is that someone needs to fuga de la fuga. Because with this hilly terrain, with Bovin under pressure for Israel, the tug buddy of Woods, and with Woods being, you know, this climb is something that Woods probably could do well in from the GC group, frankly. It's a really good climb for him where he can be out of the saddle for a long period of time on steep, steep ramps. And the other guys in that group are nowhere near his climbing, except maybe a Berthe, maybe, who looked good on a short pull on Marie Blanc. But still, Woods was with the GC guys in the Basque Country Grand Départ, like the last six guys on the really steep ramp. So everyone has a target on his back. So it's actually not the best situation for him. With Bovin gone, attacks start flying, Benji. There's attacks from Moritz, Latour, Paulus, Jorgensen. People want to get up the road.
I swear Bovin was one of the first attacks of them all.
Yeah, I know. That's a bit strange to me.
I expected Bovin to be the controlling rider for Woods in all these situations, and it seemed to be different. But the weirdest part about it was I was expecting Woods to get completely fucked into a second split at that moment when those Moritz attacks started happening. But the first group was a group of five riders, Jorgensen, Woods, Lutsenko, Gregaard, and Burgodot, and went up the road. And Woods was in there in the final split for a bit, because then we saw an attack by Campenaerts and Berthe behind, which closed that group again. But loads of attacks started flying again, right?
Exactly. And this is from far out, because this is the thing. Once a breakaway gets 10 minutes, and these are not riders who care about taking time back on GC like a Jai Hindley, they no longer care about pushing the gap out to 15 minutes. They don't need 15 minutes to win the stage. So they're going to stop cooperating. They need 1 second to win the stage from the GC group. So, you know, this is why with the gap so big and no GC team controlling whatsoever, that really played into the hands of the Fuga de la Fuga people, which is a Chente, one of the DSs for Movistar Special. Jorgensen, gets stung in the helmet by a bee. I think he was asking for antihistamines. This was, I think, before the attacks.
Yep.
And then Jorgensen goes clear. And then a second group is on the road of De La Cruz, Paulus, Burgodot, I think, and Moritz. And that group is not really working that well. Like Moritz is doing Moritz things where he's accelerating a lot, stopping, accelerating, stopping, that sort of straight up attacking the group. There's these little rises as well where I think Jorgensen got away. And so Paulus is getting frustrated with him. He wants to get it clear. Woods is losing a lot of time, though, because now Astana have a rider up the road in De La Cruz, so Lutsenko's not pulling behind. And Movistar have Jorgensen ahead, so Gorka Izagirre isn't pulling. And EF have got Powell's one of the stronger riders, and so is... And Bergadeau's ahead, so Pierre Latour won't pull. So is Berthe... It was basically up to Berthe, Woods, and Campenaerts, and the Uno X rider, Gregard, to pull. And it's like, they're not good. They just lost so much time, and I thought Woods is losing the stage right here.
To be clear, the gaps were at that point when we're starting the last climb, the Puy de Dôme climb, where the differences can be collapsed easier by the real climbers. Jorgensen ahead, solo. Then 55 seconds to Paulus Mohoric and Burgodó. De La Cruz had lost time. Was that because of a puncture?
De La Cruz dropped his chain and then they tried to get it back on. It was on a quick descent. It was the descent into Puy de Dôme. He tried to stay with the group. And then he eventually, the mechanic leaned out and I was like, you are going to rip your fingers off on live television if you touch that chain.
Illegal, by the way.
Yeah, I think, well, he was going to and then he stopped. He was going to and he stopped. And then he, I think, changed bike or whatever. Yeah. And that, but then he's in a Shasta Tat. He's just sat just in front of the Lutsenko group. So both of them are really going nowhere. And so, yeah, Jorgensen starts that climb, the Puy de Dôme. This is the full climb, by the way, with over 2 minutes on the Woods group. Fortunately for him, Victor Campenaerts just got on the front of that group and just started driving it.
Yep.
And I was like, why? Like, I mean,
what else does he have to do here?
Try and get the best possible stage result for himself.
Possibly. Maybe he thinks that by pacing he can drop people.
Maybe he wanted to. Did he beat the peloton?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, he beat the peloton by 3 minutes. So he didn't. There is no reasonable explanation for why Campenaerts will pull Mike Woods on the descent in the first start. He pulled him on the first part of the Puy de Dôme. Now, this is the 7% section. And here, Jorgensen's very strong. He holds the gap stable to that group. Paulus, Moritz, and co. just attack each other. Paulus first attacks, then Moritz goes clear. And I thought Jorgensen had it at this point because Campenaerts pulls off Benji, and I'm like, it's still 2 minutes, 1:50. Yeah. There's no one pulling in group three now on the road. Group two is just split everywhere. I don't think Moritz is going to drop Jorgensen, and he's looking good. And it looks like an American victory, Benji. It looked even like, you know, Sepp Kuss was looking fresh in the back as well. It could be a great day for America. Mike Woods. Do you think Mike Woods knew that the gap was comfortable, or he just had no choice? And because in the end, it looks like perfect timing.
I think he had no choice, man.
Yeah.
I think if he was in the third group on 2 minutes, I saw 16 at some point in the first 3 kilometers of the climb, then he was probably thinking, fuck, I'm fucked here. There's no way I'm getting to the front anymore. But the thing is, those last 4 kilometers are so bloody good for this man. Like, it's ideal. We mentioned yesterday as one of the most likely candidates to win from the breakaway that a Woods candidate is so good on this finish, but that he hasn't been able to get in the break in Mont Blanc, for example, because he was too close in GC. But now he's far enough in GC to do this, and he's in the breakaway, but then this happens. And we get towards the steeper sections, and that's where we start seeing some weakness in Jorgensen, but not directly by Woods, because Woods was still off camera behind. Moritz was closing in.
And nice.
I did not expect Mohoric to be anywhere near this victory.
Well, that's when it was clear that Jorgensen was in big, big trouble, because if he's losing this much time to Moritz now, he's just bleeding time gradually. Just the seconds just ticked down from 106 and it just went down a second, and suddenly it's at 40 seconds. And at the same time, you have Mike Woods is... Now, the camera work, I don't think... Because there's three camera bikes, I think. Camera bike on Jorgensen, camera bike on Moritz, camera bike on Peloton. And so the Woods group was barely shown. Like, I have no idea when he attacked. I have no idea who pulled that group before. I don't know. But Woods, we saw in the distance 30 seconds behind Moritz on the steep ramps, but he looked close because it's so steep. And he's coming back. And now we're like, is Woods going to crack himself because he left himself too much to do and he's having to come back this much? But in the end, he just gets up to Moritz, straight drops him off the wheel, bang, gone. And then with 1.5Ks or 1K to go, he only needed 21 seconds on Jorgensen, and then it was done. 1K at 12%, 11.5%. He put that into Jorgensen easily because that's still going to take them about, I don't know, 4 minutes at this point. So, Woods gets up to Jorgensen's wheel, attacks, and you just see Jorgensen's shoulders slump.
I can imagine.
Yeah. After being in the Fuga de la Fuga for so long and to have Mike Woods come back. And yeah, without Campenaerts, Woods probably doesn't win. But a big, big day for North America. It was between Woods and Jorgensen. Mike Woods wins the stage, the second. I mean, Israel have been really good in the Tour the last couple of years. They win a stage in week one on Peter Dome with Mike Woods, a lot of UCI points too. And Pierre Latour and Morich. Pierre Latour came out of nowhere, only finished 28 seconds back. That was crazy. He was in the Woods group, and he actually went past Bergodeau. Morich actually just sprinted past Jorgensen, who didn't even finish on the podium. I dare say he got a bit demoralized when Woods passed him and Morich kept chugging away. But heartbreak for Jorgensen, but a really good battle from the break, Benji, actually.
Yeah, I believe so as well, because that comeback was so intense. And this was one of the most impressive breakaway victories of the year. I think if I had to add another one to the mix was the Magnus Cort breakaway win, where he just was about to get caught by the peloton and then launched with 400 meters to go in some French early season race. Might have been Bessège, I'm not sure about it. But that was also one where I put up there. But this stage was super impressive, being 2 minutes back, not even at the start of the climb, but like 2.5 kilometers into the climb. And then being able to make that up towards the end of the climb on a rider that, yeah, is suffering, but still is a top rider. Eh? Matteo Jorgensen is going to Jumbo-Visma most likely. And looking at the situation, I don't know. I feel like, could he have done this already before? As in, could he have won Marie Blanc already?
I mean, he tried getting in breakaways, I think. I mean, he's been trying
all
week.
Yeah, but he was super close, eh?
Yeah.
He was on 55 seconds, I swear, on Marie Blanc stage.
You almost said Woods.
Woods.
Oh, Woods. Yeah, no, Woods, 100% agree. And that's the thing, though. They have to get forced into this position. Like, he came fifth and sixth on the first. Like, was Mike Woods ever going for GC at this race?
Realistically, no.
Like, what was their plan?
I think he saw the first two stages. I think a lot of riders should have those first two stages, try and go for the stage by being in the GC group, because that was the most likely way to win stage one, for example. But then if you go further, you see that stage five and the opportunity, lose time on a bloody sprint stage.
Yeah, lose time on stage three or four, and then you can get in the break to Laurent. And you're right, like, who won that stage? Hindley.
Yeah. Well, oops.
Maybe Woods doesn't beat him. That'd be tough. But yeah, magnificent fight from the breakaway. Teams in there, and Quickstep will be ruined. I don't think Alaphilippe beats Woods on this finish anyway, frankly, like, given Woods' form. There's not many guys except for maybe a goal or... I don't know. There's a reason Woods was like the third favorite for this stage, which is very, very short for the breakaway guy. He was the next guy after Vingegaard and Pogacar for this stage. But anyway, big for Israel Premier Tech. Back to the GC group. Basically, nothing happens. Fight for position into the base of Puy de Dôme. They're 16 minutes back. Obviously, they claw that in. UAE, actually, and Ineos wave over Jumbo, and Jumbo, who had maintained good position.
DSM.
DSM, Niels Ekhoff put Bardet in good position. I apologize. But yeah, Jumbo were nowhere. It was just Vingegaard at the front. And all of a sudden, Wout van Aert comes back to the front and he starts pacing the 5K, 7.5% section. So they were obviously trying to turn the stage, the climb, into the longest climb possible. And yeah, he was setting a decent pace, Benji, but it wasn't like infernal. Like, there was still Danny van Poppel there. There was still a pretty big group for a long time until maybe Kelderman pulled at the end, and it was still like multiple teams still had multiple riders. Like, in UAE still had three or four, and Ineos still had three at that point.
I do have to fully expose you now, because we were watching this together, and when Danny van Poppel showed up on the screen, you shouted something that he was Belgian. Did you really think van Poppel was Belgian?
I mean, I actually did. Yeah, I kind of did. I've always thought he's Belgian. I don't know why. Is Boy van Poppel Belgian?
No.
Is that his brother?
Yeah, it is. And what's his dad, Jean-Paul? That was a good sprinting guy. One of the first sprinters with an actual full lead out.
Is Baptiste Plancard Belgian?
Yes.
Yeah, see, they're all much of a muchness to me. See, these Intermarché, the Intermarché guys, I just assume they're Belgian. And to me, Van Poppel's an Intermarché rider. I still haven't acclimatized to him at Bora Hansgrohe.
So when Jumbo-Visma came to the front, Van Baarle, Van Aert, Kelderman, then Jonas Vingegaard as well on the wheel, obviously, we see that. Sepp Kuss kind of moves up on the left side, completely flies past everyone. Yeah. It was really impressive to see, obviously, to move himself in the wheel or in the train of Jonas there. And we see from that point onwards, it's first Van Baarle, then Van Aert, like you said. Then Kelderman takes over, then it switches back to Van Aert, and then back to Kelderman. Why?
So Kelderman does the steeper sections, and then there's this false flat section, as I said, and that's where you want Van Aert to pull because he's a rouleur and can pull there, and you save Kelderman for the steeper section later. So, but as I said, the group, we've got Soler in third wheel. Vingegaard and Pogacar were sitting deeper in the group, so they, with that flat section before the steep section, they were trying not to, both of them, not to take too much wind. We saw Pogacar's teammates doing a really, really good job. All of them, they got all their bid-ons, every one of them, because there was the last bid-on collection, and they were pouring water over him. It was a hot day, obviously. Vingegaard was there with Kuss. Kelderman comes back. And to be honest, I didn't see any GC rider dropping at all on the first half of the climb. O'Connor slipping was the only thing that really happened.
Yeah, true. O'Connor was slipping, and we saw some riders just like at the back of the group and so forth, but nothing really that shouted, okay, this rider is completely exploded and off the back on this climb so far. So everything was about to come down to that real steep portion towards the end, the same steep portion that Woods used to get to Jorgensen. And that's with roughly 4.5 to 4 kilometers to go where Sepp Kuss starts taking over. Sepp Kuss, GC Kuss is on, he's on there, but he starts pacing, and we did not see much from the breakaway at this point. Let's be honest about it. The second that Woods crossed the line, we saw rider two cross the line, then rider three, then rider four. Then we saw an interview with Woods. Then we saw the Puy de Dôme from the helicopter. Then we saw rider six, rider seven, rider eight. Then we switched back to the GC group. Kuss, Vingegaard, Poggi, Simon Yates, Carlos Rodriguez, Tom Pidcock, and Adam Yates.
We say Hindley was there as well.
Yeah,
and Hindley was in third position though, so take note of that. And it, as I said, like the whatever producer's decision to show panoramic footage, like no offense to like Jonas Grigard or Bergodeau or Luchenko, but like they're coming 7th, 8th, and 9th on the stage, and it's the Puy de Dôme, and you put it here for the GC action. Now, of course, show Woods winning the stage, and even show the guys coming 2nd and 3rd as they cross, if you must. But yeah, showing. 8th crossing the line was a bit much, and everyone was begging to watch the GC guys battle it out, because when Kuss is doing a lead out, you think something's going to happen, and nothing really did happen. That was the thing, nothing did happen. He's pacing. Hindley slides the back, Hindley gets dropped, Adam Yates slides, he goes to the back, and he gradually gets dropped too. So Yates and Hindley dropped, Adam that is. Simon Yates is in second wheel. He slides back. Pidcock starts moving up, actually, on the right-hand side, on the open side. And then eventually, I think Pidcock started pacing harder because they were getting Rodriguez, moving him closer to the podium, and Kuss basically dropped.
Yeah, I feel like it was a combination of Kuss stopping pacing that triggered Pidcock to move up and start pacing again, because at a certain point, Kuss kind of lowered his tempo, was talking to Jonas for a bit, and then dropped. And then on the right side, we see Pidcock moving up. But that tempo seemingly wasn't super high compared to what other riders wanted to do, because from that point on, we saw attacks. And I think Simon Yates was one of the ones that attacked early as well. He went, and then Pidcock jumped on the wheel, and then Pogacar jumped on that wheel, then Vingegaard closed Pogacar. But then eventually, I feel like Simon Yates tried that one more time, but then one of the big two would attack, right?
Yes, Yates, a big acceleration. He kept it going this time. The first one was a little dab. Ineos basically don't react to this one, and they didn't really show what Ineos did at that point.
Yeah.
And here comes the big counterattack from Pogacar. He goes, Vingegaard's in the wheel, and he's in the wheel, and he's looking good, and then Pogacar keeps it going, and then suddenly, and here's the really key thing, I think. When the pace is slow, and so it happened on Colteray, where the pace slowed down, Vingegaard stops. The pace slowed down, Yates had attacked and stopped. When Pogacar hits Vingegaard with he hits him with like a 25-second burst. I think for Vingegaard to follow that hurts Vingegaard way more than Pogacar. And it's almost like Vingegaard shouldn't even follow initially and should go back to his steady state climber and just pace this long time to go. I can claw it back, because Colteray, that's not possible, because Colteray then flattened off. You want to be in the draft. This is different. This is 13% all the way to the line. And I think that initial burst from Poggi basically creates the gap. Well, it didn't really, but I think it puts Jonas into a lot of difficulty. Yeah. And then the gap goes from basically, it just inches out like really slowly. So you can't say that Vingegaard he didn't full crack because he was off the wheel for quite a long time, maybe a kilometer or longer, like quite a long time. But yeah, Poggy's just looking good and pacing and pacing and pacing, and Vingegaard's not getting any closer. And then we're wondering, is Yellow in play? And yeah, I was surprised. But so yeah, it's another top performance from Pogacar.
When Pogacar made that attack, you're right, that I agree with your theory that maybe the reason that Vingegaard has trouble with these attacks is because it launches from a slow tempo. Pogacar does his brutal attack, and then Vingegaard is in the red a bit. And then when Pogacar keeps on pushing it, he doesn't have that reflection of being able to follow anymore, because he was on the wheel initially. Like,
he was
on the wheel. It took him 10 seconds until he was on a bit of a gap.
Yeah.
And then he was on 5 meters for 30 seconds. He was on 10 meters for 30 seconds again. And I was like, Jesus, this is intense. Because I was like, is he going to get back? He looks like he's getting back on this screen. But 1 second later, he looks like he's not getting back. And 1 second later, I have hope again for Vingegaard. And the next second, I see Pogacar sliding away again. And it's like, on one end, you want that initial separation if you're Pogacar.
Yeah.
On one end, you want to prevent that if you're Vingegaard. But what if Vingegaard does something when Kuz is off the front? Because, like, on one end, it's likely that he gets countered afterwards. Let's say Vingegaard attacks if Kuz is off the front in that group. Because that's what you'd expect, right? Is Vingegaard not attacking a sign for Pogacar that Vingegaard is scared?
I think so. I think Pogacar's always going to try, right? So, you know, he's always going to try. And he obviously, he's going to try his burst. I've never really seen Pogacar attack and get countered before. So when he does attack, he must feel good. Maybe he has, if I don't remember exactly. But yeah.
Usually he drops people.
usually he drops people. Anyway, I thought it was going to be Colteray 2.0. Mm-hmm. So I was actually very surprised that in the end, Pogacar keeps going. Vingegaard still has something left. And Pogacar, quote-unquote, only takes 8 seconds on Jonas Vingegaard at this finish. And I thought it could have been much worse. I thought when he initially gapped Vingegaard and then Vingegaard has the Colteray issue, that he would be losing a lot more time. And he actually keeps the yellow jersey. So an interesting stage. Was it like the Weider Dome? I mean, maybe the organizers would hope GC went for it, but they didn't, and we got two fights. So Woods wins the stage ahead of Latour, Moritz third, Jorgensen fourth, then Berthe Powers, Lutsenko, Gregard. In terms of GC, Pogacar first from the GC guys, 8 seconds ahead of Vingegaard, then a big gap. So the two guys were head and shoulders above the rest. Pogacar 50 seconds ahead of Yates, Simon that is, and Thomas Pidcock, who actually goes with Simon Yates. There might have been a bit of cat and mouse. Carlos Rodriguez, actually, he was a minute behind Vingegaard, so he got a little bit dropped by Simon and Adam. Simon and Tom Pidcock, the two Yates are confusing. And then Adam Yates, another 7 seconds behind Carlos Rodriguez. Hindley would lose to his podium bidders, to Simon, his Yates. He lost 23 seconds. So Hindley lost a bit of his advantage, and then the rest of the GC guys lost loads of time.
When it comes to Carlos Rodriguez, I see some talk on social media. Why does Pidcock not wait on the final stretch of the finish line when Rodriguez is dropping from the wheel of Pidcock and one of the Yatesies? Well, obviously it's super steep. How much do you reckon draft matters on a climb like this at that point?
I mean, like, yeah, a watt or two, a watt or three, like, yeah, it maybe matters a little bit. And pacing, they've done studies to show that psychologically pacing, you know, because yeah, you do it in the wind tunnel and 12%, and it's like, okay, there's no real drafting advantage here. But then they do actual studies in real life where people have someone pace them on a steep climb, and they always perform better with someone pacing them. So it for sure makes a difference. But in the last K, when everyone's going full gas, I know, I think there might have been a little bit of games, though, with the Simon Yates, Pidcock, and Rodriguez group. But big day for Ineos. I mean, yeah, they're not up with Vingegaard and Pogacar, but they were. This was a surprising performance from Pidcock, I would say.
Better
than I expected.
One of the best GC days of his career, I'd say, and kind of gives me hope for GC Pidcock in the future, gotta be honest. Like, his time trials leading up to this Tour de France have been relatively awful. Like, he's had good time trials in the past, but not recent. And then to see what he's doing here after what looked like a mess start to the Tour de France GC-wise for Pidcock, he's doing a lot better at the moment than if he keeps up this progress throughout the Tour de France, he might be at the top step at the end.
Exactly, yeah. If he proves like this, I mean, he lost 3 minutes on Tourmalet, but so did, you know, that was with most of the GC group because they got gapped on Tourmalet, and then the gap blew out to the two head guys. So GC, revised GC standings, Vingegaard 17 seconds ahead of Pogacar, Hindley on 240, so he loses a little bit of his advantage, but nothing too disastrous. The gap, obviously, between first, second, the two ahead, and Hindley grows a lot. Rodriguez on 422, Adam on 439, Simon Yates 444. So Simon Yates would still be in fourth if he hadn't had that crash yesterday. And also, I wonder how that affected him. But so no changes in the top six. And then Pidcock jumps two positions. He finishes on, he's on 526 and seventh. Gaudu got dropped quite badly. He got paced by Pino. He finished with Menkes. He's on 601 on eighth. Kuss moves up to ninth, and Bardet drops another two positions to 10th on 658. So not a good day for the French climbers. Gaudu and Bardet, they're almost getting to the point, both of them now, where they can get in the breakaway at 6 minutes and 7 minutes. Gaudu and Bardet, like in week two and three. So it'll be interesting to see, because it's not just that Gaudu's losing time, but he doesn't look as strong as the two Ineos guys, nor the Yates brothers, nor Hindley. So it'll be interesting to see how Groupama play the rest of, and Bardet in fact for DSM, how they play the rest of the 2 weeks.
Exactly, because we've seen scenarios before in previous Tour de France is that riders can use the last week, breakaways in the last week, whether it's on like a Courchevel stage, probably difficult on that stage to gain time there on many of your competitors for top five, but they can find stages where they can gain time on top five competitors by going in the breakaway. And that's what a lot of riders should be doing, not just Gaudu and Bardet, but I feel like Bilbao was in the perfect space for that on 7:37 right now. Menkes isn't really that rider, I think. He's done that before in the Vuelta, but I feel like in the Tour, I'm not sure that will work out for him. I feel like he's the follower of the GC group and hope that it's all right.
Yeah.
And
where is Menkes on?
He is on 12th, 8:50 down.
He's going to get in a breakaway.
He definitely will try.
Yeah.
But whether that will work or not, I guess we'll see. Bilbao also in a good spot, but I think he should probably work for Hindley's podium at this point.
Bilbao's going to work his way in to the top 10. He always finishes top 10. Points jersey, Philipsen, healthy lead into the first rest day. KOM, because the breakaway went all the way and because Paulus ended up, you know, he took some points, I think, in sixth because it was an all-category climb. Pogacar and the GC guys lost positions. In fact, Woods moves above all those guys because he took the full 20. So that goes to show how important the big climbs are. Like feasting on the small ones isn't that useful. Pogacar, obviously, 4 minutes ahead of Rodriguez. Bahrain always go for teams. Bahrain, the leading teams classification. They jump two positions. They always go for it.
The new Movistar.
I hadn't really thought of teams, to be honest. Anyway. Any other thoughts from this stage, Benji? Is the Tour de France over? Is Pogacar just getting stronger and, you know, dropping Jonas on a climb like this very, very steep? And, you know, it's not a 2 minute climb or a 5 minute climb. It's a 15 minute steep effort on Puy de Dôme. How do you see the relative strengths of the two top guns now?
First of all, the Tour de France is never over. We've got a situation of 17 seconds in between in GC. That's nothing. That could go away in a single mountain stage, in a single time trial even. You don't know what's going to happen in a time trial. For example, Pogacar got sniped past Vingegaard in the time trial. If he has a good time trial, when Vingegaard has a mid time trial, it can happen on every single stage that is somewhat GC related. That being said, I think it's also one of the closest GCs after stage 9 we've seen in recent history. Last year was about 39 seconds, if my memory serves me right. It was 2 minutes or something on O'Connor from Pogacar after Tignes 2 years ago. And the rest I can't be bothered remembering. So it's a situation that is racking up to be one of the closest Tour de France's, hopefully, that we've seen recently.
They're very close
so
in level, yeah.
I feel like if I look at the next couple of stages that are coming, the likes of a Grand Colombier mountain stage, for example, that is the kind of stage where I don't expect major gaps in the first place. So
I don't expect major gaps, but I expect UAE to pace for the stage win that day.
For the bonus seconds, maybe Pogacar gets a bit closer again. Yeah. But then the next stage, like the Morzine stage, the one where you have the combination of the Podden climb, Jouplaine, with Ramos in front of it, that's a stage that could be like a hidden GC stage, a stage that could truly be a GC stage with a breakaway fighting out maybe in front, or you never know. But that's one of the stages where the differences can be made again. So we're looking at roughly five stages until we see proper gaps in the GC again. So is the last 8 days of this tour that will decide the Tour de France, which I like that. I like when the Tour de France is decided in the last 8 days instead of the first week, for example, in 2021.
Yeah. And the gap last year, 39 seconds with Pogacar leading. So it's interesting, isn't it? The momentum's a big thing.
Yeah.
Like the momentum feels all Pogacar's way right now, but he's actually, Vingegaard is 54 seconds better, in a 54 second better position than he was last year at this time. But the momentum is, the problem is Pogacar had the lead last year and he'd also not been dropped. He'd also won two stages already in the first week. So yeah, we're not doing a rest day podcast tomorrow. We're taking an actual rest day, but yeah, before we preview stage 10 and give our picks for that one.
When it comes to Pogacar and Vingegaard, I also feel like I have a harder time figuring out where this Tour de France is going to go from this point onwards. Because last year, we knew second week the large climbs were going to happen, and we knew at that point that Vingegaard was looking better for those climbs, but we didn't necessarily know if that was going to be enough to overthrow Pogacar for the entire Tour de France. But when I look at this Tour de France, I'm like, yeah, based on that theory, then Col de la Loche should work out for Vingegaard. But I feel like Pogacar has fought back in a way that I also didn't expect after stage 5 when he dropped on Mati Blanc and lost a minute. So it's like, you don't know what to trust anymore when it comes to the assumptions we had after previous races. Does that make any sense for you while you're killing that fly?
Yeah, to get that one. He's been irritating me, distracting me all podcast. They harass me. They know that they wind me up. Will Pogacar keep this level for the whole Tour de France? Because, yeah, what happened on Marie Blanc? How did he get dropped so badly on Marie Blanc? It was a longer... Because the thing is, again, the steep section of Puy de Dôme today was shorter than Marie Blanc overall, but then Puy de Dôme overall, they would have done very, very hard. So, you know, Pogacar obviously very, very, very strong and yeah, in top form, top physical form. So I don't want to hear no wrist excuses. I think he's even taken the wrist. He's got the brace off, right?
I haven't checked.
I've seen on his, I think he's got nothing on. He's just riding with gloves. So yeah, it's locked, but I would say, yeah, momentum is all UAE in Pogacar's way, and they didn't have to do anything today, actually. It's one of the first times I can remember where, apart from Tourmalet, obviously, where Jonas set him up, but that's, yeah, Jumbo-Visma have done, they did the work or set up the climb. I mean, were Jumbo-Visma wrong, Benji, for trying to make this a long climb?
I don't think so, because, like, I would expect that to go into the advantage of Vingegaard based on previous races, but
yeah,
it's also not a climb that is 55 minutes, you know? So yes, the last portion is hard. It's probably a 35 minute climb. I don't know how long they did over it.
Oregon 33 minutes. Yeah, it's over 30 minutes.
Yeah. So it's not like the 50 minute climb that we see. What climb was it last year again? The one before Grand Galibier, for example.
Yeah.
So that's a fucking long climb. Tourmalet is a long climb.
Yeah.
This climb is hard and it's a bit shorter than that. So it's kind of in the middle ground where Pogacar can still, I don't know.
And how much do they rest in the middle of it? I don't know. Like, because, yeah, is it, do they really rest? Does it make a difference? It surely makes a difference, the flat a bit in the middle. I don't know.
How much do you reckon the spent energy before the climb counts for either of them?
I mean, in theory, like, the heat hurts Pogacar, right? But I don't even know if that's true. Pogacar's performed well in, Puy-Marie in 2020. It's not like he just completely crumbles every time it's over 30 degrees.
Yeah.
It's certainly if you're having a bad day and you mess something up, nutrition or fueling or drink-wise, then, yeah, it's going to be tough for you, tougher for you in the heat than a mild 15 degrees. So, I don't know. It's tough to say. Like, you can try and see patterns everywhere, but honestly, like, Puy de Dôme, they haven't really done an effort like that before head-to-head against each other, because even Marie Blanc wasn't like that. But yeah, week two.
Was today a disappointment in terms of GC action? Because I swear not much happened in hindsight.
I mean, for the first six positions, for no change in the first six positions, and for GC not to win, yeah, it wasn't terrible. People went for it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Kuss reduced to 5, and then there was attacks, and then Pogacar counted, and then there was a gap. So it's not like nothing happened, but was it the Anquetil, Poulidor, barnstorming thing they might have hoped for before the first rest day? No. But, you know, even if there was, they wouldn't have shown it on TV anyway, because they were showing Clément Berthet crossing the line in 7. So maybe we're glad it didn't happen. As I said, because we'll do our preview of stage 10 now. It's stage 10 from Volcania to Issoire, 168 Ks. I dare say this will be very hot. It's in the middle of France coming out. Volcania is, I think, just near Puy de Dôme, like just because it's on the west of Clermont-Ferrand. And isn't Puy de Dôme a volcano anyway?
Is that why you're referring to it as being close? Because Volcania has Vulcan in the name and Puy de Dôme is a volcano?
Yes. That's exactly why. And I can see
perfect
it on,
logic.
And I can see it on a map. It's just west of Clermont-Ferrand.
Break.
Yeah, 100% break stage. Like, no one's going to chase it. I mean, if Trek thought yesterday was going to be a break,
yeah,
and they were going to try and get Pedersen in the break on that stage to Limoges, then this is a break. I mean, it opens with 5Ks, 5% up and down. Descent lumpy all day. Actually, virtually no flat in the stage at all, with just medium mountain climbs. Mark Hirschi would have won this in 2020 probably, or Wild Conrad or Colbrelli. Yeah, it's got, and then the last climb is 6.6Ks, 5.5%. Paulus should take the day off here, I think, because even though the stage suits him, the KOM points, there's not enough on offer to merit the energy. And I think we'll get rolled anyway. The finish is flat, though. There's a descent from the last climb, about 16Ks of descending, and mostly it's flat finishing in Issoire. So, nailed on break. Port will be in it. I think Pedersen will try and get in it. Quinn Simmons would have probably got in this break, but he went home this morning because of his injuries, unfortunately. But yeah, Wout van Aert will be the favorite, I think, for this stage. And I think Van der Poel will jump in the break too.
I think so as well. And I think we'll have that scenario where Wout van Aert is in the breakaway, Mathieu van der Poel is in the breakaway, Kort is in the breakaway, and everybody realizes that these are faster men. And then someone like Mohoric will subtly slip away and ride off into the distance and win the stage. Like, I swear that we had that scenario before, right? We had that in 2021, one of the stage seven, I'm pretty sure it was. I'm not 100% certain, but that was the kind of scenario. And yeah, Mohoric wins the stage that way.
I mean, he looked good today. I mean, he came third on the Puy de Dôme finish. Yeah. And that's super steep. He was coming back to Jorgensen. So I think we'll see Jorgensen. I think we'll see a lot of the guys who saw on the break today back in the break. I think we're going to see double Israel. Like, why wouldn't we see double Israel in this breakaway? Dylan Terns. Woods, I don't see it for him. Simon Clark is a really, Chris Nalens, this suits him well. Even Corbin Strong and Schultz. So Israel will have two.
It's going to seven riders in the break.
Yeah, maybe. It's going to be a break of 20, I think, at least. Yeah. And Quickstep got to make this. Alaphilippe has to make this break with a partner. Has to, because he has a really, really good chance to win this stage if he conserves his energy. And I think Matawas for FDJ, I'd love to see him and Kung in there too. So I'm going with Michał Kwiatkowski to win this stage. I think he looks really, really good. He was in this break in Courtrai, and his result there didn't belie his actual strength. So I think Kwiatkowski wins the stage, and I think Ineos, they want a stage win. So I think he'll get in there. He should try and get in there with they won't put two in because they'll worry about GC. So it'll just be Kwiatko, but he's smart.
Yep, I think that's a good pick.
Shouldn't Betty all win this or like be good on this?
He should be good on this, but I think Kort is better on this.
Betiol. Like, he won RVV.
Yeah.
And there's all these stages, like, you think, and he might go and win this stage, but he's very, you can never, like, with some riders, like, okay, Wout van Aert's a special beast. You say, okay, Wout van Aert will be getting this breakaway most likely. You can guess that. But, you know, like, Betiol, he might not even try. And you're like, why? Like, it's really, I mean, maybe he's been targeting it and he's like, this stage suits me and he'll get in. I don't know. But he's a very difficult rider, Betiol, to pick.
Yeah.
When he's good and when he's going to be jumping in. Fred Wright, could be him.
Yeah.
In British 100% be him. Yeah. Fred Wright, too. Anyway, that's our picks. Otherwise, in other news, Benji and I, inspired by Puy de Dôme, we did our own little mountain test today, but it was 5K, 6%, not 5Ks, 11%. Up to PAL. We just wanted to test ourselves out, so we thought we'd fill you in on that. What did you end up doing, Benji? What was the improvement?
The improvement when it comes to my ride. The thing is, like, I got to add some context here.
Okay,
right?
Give some
context. I started this kind of journey of jumping into cycling and becoming a better cyclist towards roughly December, end of December, something like that. And I had an FTP test, which you can find on YouTube if you want. I had that in end of December somewhere, where I did a 20-minute FTP test, where the result was 201 watts for 20 minutes, which resulted in an FTP of 190 watts. So pretty shit for a guy of my weight, let's be honest about it. And throughout these 6 months, I've done training, I've done challenges left and right to try and get better at cycling and to try and see improvement. And I've noticed improvement along the way. I've done ramp tests every now and then to see the results. And going into today's ride, those 5 kilometers, 6%, I was hoping that I would get a result similar to the tests I've done indoor, because indoor tests, like the ramp test I did indoors, I had a result of 257 watts, but I don't really 100% trust the ramp test.
That was your FTP.
Yeah, that was my FTP in a ramp test, but I didn't feel like I could replicate that on the road. And I was hoping that I would get relatively close to that, because I was expecting my FTP to be somewhere around 230, 240 at this point in my journey. And I went on the road, I smashed the pedals, I was dying left and right, and the result was, I think I broke my 15-minute, my 20-minute, my 30-minute, and my 45-minute power. And to note, we didn't even ride for 45 minutes all out, so
yeah.
I must have never gone 45 minutes all out before either, because otherwise I wouldn't get that. But to be able to break those records, and for those records to be, I think, 20 minutes, 244 watts, and 30 minutes, 241 watts is a major improvement in 6 months. So I'm really, really happy. And yeah, I hope it can continue.
How'd you paced it? Yeah, you paced it pretty well. I shouted at you a little bit.
I feel like the first half I did at, was it 241, 243 watts? And then the second half, which had the steeper section, I paced at 241 watts, which I was dying in the last like kilometer. You saw it, you were in my wheel. Like I was terrible in that situation. So I was trying to hold 200 at that point, but I paced hard at the initial part of the steep section at the end, to the point that I could afford going 220 by the end. But yeah, I'm happy about my pacing. Maybe there's some perfection that can happen if I negative split it a bit more, but I was just trying to survive, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, good improvement from you. I don't really know where my, like, I haven't really done a test recently, so I was pretty happy with it. I paced, I think I did first, I did, what, 1940? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first 9 minutes were 245, and then I went, I think the last, I did 280 for the last 8 minutes. So I 240 and 280 is a little bit lopsided, did 260. I have no idea what I weigh. The scales broke, not because I didn't break them, like, myself. They just, there's water got into them or they malfunctioned.
Yeah.
Maybe. But yeah, I was pretty happy with that. We'll see. So in the Vuelta, we're going to keep training. Mm-hmm. Obviously use 2 bid-ons because that made me go slower. So then when we do the test again, when you're here for the Vuelta, I can, I'll go quicker just by default.
Is that what why you had like 7 bricks in your back pocket?
Yeah, exactly.
That explains a lot. I thought it would have gone like 300 watts, mate.
Disc brake was rubbing, everything going wrong. But yeah.
I was really sad that I didn't see you on your 1 meter bike going, what is it? How many watts for 50 seconds?
1500 watts, 50 seconds. Yeah, but I can't hold it. It's a longer than a 50 second climb. That's the problem. So yeah, whilst I can do that. Anyway, we'll have the video on the LRCP YouTube channel tomorrow of that. If you want to check that out, that'll be a little bit of rest day content for you. That's why we preluded this. I should have preluded this story with that. Yeah, we'll have a video of that. If you're bored on your rest day, you want to see people in Tour de France condition climbing up mountains.
Unfortunately, it's my last day here Andorra. I'm leaving you. So tomorrow we'll be, 2 days from now, we'll be separated screens again, which is unfortunate. I had fun here.
Yeah, it's been good to have you all here. Let us know, do you enjoy the podcast when we're in person more? Do you feel they're different? How are they different? I'm sure people enjoyed the watch-alongs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let us know your feedback on how it is in person, and maybe, you know, for the world. Well, we'll do it for the first week of the Vuelta for sure, but we'll see, you know. So maybe for other races or classics next year as well, we can keep expanding it if you think it's a real addition to the podcast. But yeah, thanks for your support. It's been a really, really good first week of the tour, actually, filled with action. I've been really happy with it, and the GC is still close. So really great stuff. And we'll see you on Tuesday with the recap of that breakaway stage. Until then, ciao.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.